we were seeing in, you know, before the COVID hit, low to moderate income families who were trying to get from out that, and giving, helping them, you know, either figure out if it was schooling or if it was their jobs. What was recognized through COVID is that our systems were messed up, right? COVID exposed the systems.
Welcome to Syracuse Speaks. I'm Katie Sulkowski, joined by WAER News Director Chris Bolt.
The coronavirus pandemic has caused health and fiscal strain across the community, and it continues to, even as parts of the economy reopen. But organizations who help those struggling say the problems aren't new. They're existing problems that have been made worse by the effects of COVID-19.
Two local nonprofits published separate assessments earlier in the summer with this exact finding. Greater Syracuse Hope and Peace Inc. are now trying to inform policymakers and empower the community with this data. Their latest endeavor, the White Paper Series, offers historical context to current issues in two pages. I sat down with the authors, Executive Director of Greater Syracuse Hope, Osha Keaton, and Community Engagement Manager of Peace Inc., Todd Gailey, to talk about the struggles the community is still facing and how their findings can guide solutions. You guys both had these surveys that you did in probably late May, like around Memorial Day. Mm-hmm. Yours was in late June that you stopped collecting survey answers.
Yep.
And both of you kind of found that it wasn't necessarily brand new struggles for people, but just exacerbated problems. Mm-hmm. What does that look like? What does that mean exactly?
So for my survey, the Greater Syracuse Hope survey, one of, I think, the things that the survey highlighted was not just that COVID-19 exacerbated conditions, but that we didn't have a firm grip on some of the drivers of poverty in the way that we thought we did. The response to getting individuals food was phenomenal, but that's just one part. We still had people who had to shelter in place in housing conditions that weren't ideal, either because the home was had numerous violations and were already of low quality, or they had domestic issues happening in the household. And one of the ways that I have been pushing for individuals to use the data collected from our survey is, as things are happening on a policy level and a funding level, to keep those statistics in mind, and not just the data, but the qualitative part too, because we asked people about their experience, and those comments and quotes were interwoven throughout the report. And I always strive to do that, to make sure that their community voice is centered in the conversation, because so often people get lost in the data and it becomes so analytical and so sterile, and people forget that we're talking about human beings and their lives and their quality of life.
If the community responded well in one respect, they, you know, we struggled in many other aspects. One example that's similar to what Osha just gave that kind of shows our perspective was we gathered ACLU data and NYCLU data that had showed that throughout the state, it seems to be that the school districts were able to get laptops and tablets and computers to students. But all of the other supports that goes into running a classroom, not just the instruction, but the support systems, the after-school work, the mentoring, internet, all of those aspects were really lacking, right? So 40% of the people we surveyed lacked internet or computer access, right? We knew that childcare was an issue, but a lot of these basic needs issues, or whatever you want to call them, social determinants of health or whatever, these were already long existing mm-hmm. issues. And our work, I think, from different levels showed it well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's funny when you talk about the technology gap or access to internet, because I believe that our findings were like similar too. Almost about 40% of the survey respondents said that they were lacking internet access. And I'm just thinking of one quote from a parent who said she felt like a bad mother because she just did not have the money to pay Spectrum. And I think it was like $50. She just did not have it to pay so that she could have access to the 3 months of free internet that they were offering the people in the Syracuse City School District. And so when you think about that gap, and you couple that with the fact that we were already going into the pandemic with an educational lag, because of our graduation rates, which is no secret, we all know. I can speak for some of the HOPE partners that dealt with youth. They were very, very responsive as far as delivering laptops to students, much like Todd talked about. But after you drop the laptops off, to further echo his statement, then what happens? Because they have this laptop, but they don't have internet access. Or if they do have internet access, they don't really know how to use it. It just, again, it's all these things that were bubbling underneath the surface that just adds to the stress of the pandemic. Because it's not just Syracuse. Yeah. It happened across the nation. I think that the Peace Survey did a good job highlighting that. And then also using my survey to kind of say, well, these are the immediate fears of the people who live in Syracuse, and how can we, you know, make some short-term gains as well as long-term structural and systemic changes. So I would definitely encourage people to, like, read them both, kind of like side by side.
I hear very much same but different sort of approaches to looking at the community and collecting data. And which brings you kind of to this newest endeavor in the
white paper series.
White paper series.
Yeah. Series. Okay.
We can workshop that.
Yeah.
I'm not held to that. So.
Yeah, me neither.
So for right now, we'll call it the white paper series.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Sure.
But for this new series, I mean, the first one touches on redlining, and something that I thought was maybe a little bit different or interesting for them was not just explaining in a really accessible way, but also the highlighting of protest and activism around these policies. Can you guys talk a little bit about why that was so important to include in a paper that's 2 pages long?
We had very long discussions about the importance of including that, and we both agreed that it was important to highlight that, because that's often not told when the discussion about redlining or community displacement is talked about, especially in Syracuse. So there's, like, a lot of people know about the 15th Ward and how it was basically decimated. But one of the things that's left out is that the community did fight back. They tried. But as so often happens when you're dealing with people that come from a disenfranchised group, they don't have the political capital. And when you put that in context of where we are right now, just as a nation, political capital is so important. If you kind of tie that into this whole concept of, you know, the vote and why your vote matters so much, it's because that's how you start to gain political capital. And if you don't have political capital, sometimes these are some of the consequences that come from it. Not saying that it's the community's fault, because as the paper kind of outlines, it was set up in a structural way so that they did not have political capital. Mm-hmm. But even still, they still tried to find ways to fight back. They organized. They tried to have meetings. When that didn't work, then they got outspoken, and they did, like, protests and sit-ins. there was one example that I had came across where the protesters kind of descended on one of the construction sites and they jumped on the equipment and like halted construction for that day. So they were really fighting for their lives in their homes. Unfortunately, it didn't pan out for them. But that story is important to tell because, again, it drives home the point of political capital and how important that is.
For me, to understand how structural inequalities have been put in place, but how we can also overcome them, we need to study and understand where are the spaces of contestation. So if we lack the political agency or political capital, where are the spaces that people who are being repressed can overcome that? These policies of structural inequality have been framed through white supremacy and white privilege and white policymaking. The important thing to understand is to overcome these gaps that it has to be a diverse table, and that to overcome this, it can't just be a continuation of white policymakers trying to resolve this. And by talking about and showing constant examples of, hey, basically through the history of time, people who have been repressed have found ways to resist. Mm-hmm. And we are providing very concrete examples, one about how communities who've been repressed have resisted, and two, oh, by the way, they're still doing it today. And that's really important.
In terms of leadership and people who make decisions, have you heard from the county, the state, the city about your findings? And I mean, this series, there's a lot of data here that is pretty striking.
I can say from my end, I haven't had anyone reach out to me. I've been kind of reaching out to them and saying, hey, let's talk about this stuff as far as like the survey. And then I did have the town hall, the citizens town hall, where I used the survey like as the foundation to like spark a deeper conversation. And then had Deputy Mayor, we had Senator Rachel May, Lanessa Chaplins from NYCLU, and then we had the new director from Central. So we, like, I did have the conversation, but I don't know if Ty feels the same way, but I'm just going to take this moment to be completely honest and transparent. I am a little disappointed at the lack of response, if you will, about some of the findings, because I do think both surveys have a lot to offer, especially when you're trying to troubleshoot as to like what's the next move out of the pandemic. And so sometimes in work like this, especially like research, sometimes it's not valued until people do that look back, like in the moment, because there's so much stuff going on.
I know with our work, we were, so I want to say a couple things. One, we were very insistent that this was public data and that we had no, if you want to write a grant with our data, please.
Use it,
right? I can't tell you how many times people asked for permission to use our work. So that was the first thing. So one of the things I'd like to do with the accessibility and with these papers is people need to understand that information should be open. If you're going to have a functional civil society, people need to be able to have information and access to data and access to information and ideas and data that they can understand. That's the second point. The third, our experiences were similar. We spoke with CATCO's office. The city has been completely silent. The county has been silent. We really didn't know how people were going to respond to this. I don't know if I was expecting people in political power to respond, to be blunt. What I found refreshing were the amount of people that did respond. So we got a lot of positive feedback from nonprofits. Mm-hmm. I would say the colleges. I know with this white paper, all of the colleges, I know faculty in each of the major colleges here who are assigning our work to their students right now. Our data, our report was, I think after the second day, the most engaged document that Peace had ever put on social media in its 10 years of social media. I know that people from the protest, the various protest movements have reached out to us to learn more about this. Community Foundation's been very supportive of us.
Yep.
All of this is to say I've been disappointed to some extent by the political response. But I also am not surprised. And in some ways, I'm actually kind of happy about the way it's working out, because I think for us to move forward, things need to change. And one of the things with showing the past is how much of that's been in the past continues to be in the present. But there needs to be a wider table. Mm-hmm. And so all of this is long-winded to say, I've been really happy with how the community has responded. And if anything, it's pushed me to think even more about how to make the work more accessible and presentable to different audiences.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's I feel the same way, just in thinking about how to capture not just the local political figures, but regional and national. And sometimes you can get frustrated when you're like, I'm doing all this great work here in the city and I'm doing it for our community. Pay attention. And sometimes maybe you could get lost in that, and you start to think, well, maybe what I'm doing is not that innovative. Maybe it's not that great. And then all of a sudden you have people from other areas or other cities calling you. Like, so how did you go about disseminating a survey during a pandemic and asking, you know, your opinion and your guidance on things? So it kind of helps reaffirm the work, not that you're doing it for like accolades or trophies or anything, but sometimes it's good to know like you're heading on the right path. So I think it will catch on. I think it will stick in the city of Syracuse. But I also think the city of Syracuse will probably be, and this is not the municipality, I mean the actual city. I think the actual city will probably be one of the last cities to pick it up and say, there's something to this.
Is it past experience that makes you say that? I mean,
yeah.
It's not that we want confirmation, but when we set out to do the survey and when we set out to do the white papers, at least in my mind, I was saying that we want a community response. Mm-hmm. We have successfully achieved a community response. So in that respect, I'm happy with how things have gone.
We've been hearing about what the community and policymakers are saying on the need for safe housing, unemployment, and other issues that affect people in poverty. And we'll hear more from Osha Keaton and Todd Gailey a little later on in Syracuse Speaks.
But next, what are people on the front lines of trying to reduce poverty experiencing with racism so intertwined? And how is COVID complicating their efforts? A recent virtual town hall highlighted how the fight continues on a number of fronts. This is Syracuse Speaks on 88.3 FM WAER.
So if there were whole neighborhoods where people couldn't get mortgages to buy a home, then a whole host of communities were left out of that, leaving a little inheritance to their children, building equity in their home, moving to a more expensive home, that whole process.
Digital content on WAER is made possible thanks to California Closets, creating functional home offices for those working and learning remotely, offering in-home and virtual consultations. Learn more at californiaclosets.com.
What we think worsens the conditions of the clients and the families is access to mental health services. It is a lot to deal with, to witness homicides, unaddressed trauma, depression, grief and loss. And, you know, it was kind of a perfect storm once COVID hit.
Welcome back to Syracuse Speaks. The COVID pandemic, coupled with the economic fallout from it, forced many individuals, families, and even communities into financial hardship. As you've been hearing, for those in poverty, it has exacerbated problems that already existed.
A group of people who work to alleviate poverty got together to share the impacts they're seeing in their specific areas. Programs that help those in our community train for and find jobs, improve affordable housing, work on healthcare and trauma are still trying to assist people. But their experiences show the ongoing pandemic is making those struggles harder to overcome.
What we were seeing in, you know, before the COVID hit was low to moderate income families who were trying to get from out that, right? How do I get from becoming low income? How do I build from that? Helping them, you know, either figure out if it was schooling or if it was their jobs.
Rashida Caldwell couldn't be more on the front lines of those struggling to make ends meet and dealing with poverty and racism. She's Peace Incorporated's Eastside Family Resource Center director and lost a child to gun violence 3 years ago. She's also mentored young women through her initiative, Let Me Be Great.
What was recognized through COVID is that our systems were messed up, right? COVID exposed the systems. COVID also exposed jobs, right? Pain, where people were just making it, right? We worry about hunger. People have been hungry. But what it did, it exposed it in a different way because it made people realize that so many people were only making $11, but they were working three jobs making $11. Now everyone, because the world's shut down, we were exposed to, wait a minute, if one person is making $11, but they're doing three jobs, right? But it took three jobs for them to get just above, but now they don't qualify for anything else. It helped us to figure out, put a plan together, right? How can we support families and ways to look at, you know, what we can do overall, not just for the families, but what are we doing internally to support the families?
That's a good point. COVID definitely placed a spotlight on some of those not often discussed systems gap and things that, you know, we've tried to kind of look the other way on.
Greater Syracuse Hope Director Osha Keaton convened the virtual town hall to see how poverty and racism are interconnected and how COVID has made many of those problems worse.
We've been providing services directly to clients. I've had four of my staff contract COVID, which has been scary, especially hospitalizations for a couple of them, which has been really scary.
ACR Health Executive Director Will Murtaugh is with another agency trying to continue to help people amid both health and financial blows.
You certainly don't want to lose people, you know, your staff that are helping people to COVID. It really has made us operate differently and be as careful. I mean, you know, we have to do the safe distance away from our clients, have to stand safely away from each other. We have to hand out people masks. We're doing telemedicine in our clinic versus face-to-face. And of course, I don't know, a lot of people know this, but the state has not been paying regularly. So I had to furlough 70 staff. And when you have to furlough 70 staff, that means you have less staff on hand. And at a charity, staffing and people are the program, not a thing. It's staffing and people are the program. It's human to human.
Well, it was kind of strange for me because the work that we do in the community as far as the trauma and the gunshots, at the same time COVID was happening, the number of gunshots and the violence was going up through the roof.
The mental health aspect of the COVID crisis has been identified among just about everyone impacted by the pandemic. Timothy Noble Jennings Bay researches and tries to help people with trauma through his Street Addiction Institute.
It was like dealing with one pandemic and then all of these episodes of shootings day in and day out. And I think we arrived at this place because of the lack of mental health services. Because, see, poverty is a mind state, right? You could give people a job, you could put them in better positions, but if the mind state and the value system hasn't switched, it would continue to move forward. And then once COVID came into play, it kind of blew the lid off of everything, because now when you had individuals who had unaddressed conflict because of the trauma, they didn't have access to individuals for about 2 or 3 months. And then our governor, our county exec here, our mayor, deputy mayor, they did a great job preparing us for walking into phase 1, phase 2, phase 3, phase 4. But I seen those phases unfold in the streets in the same manner, but the violence became more progressive. Phase 1, phase 2, phase 3, and phase 4.
We know where you lay your head is the most indicative place of where you're going to end up in the future, right? So where you sleep at night is the quality of education you're going to get, the access to jobs you're going to get. And what we know is there are entire regions within Syracuse where they don't allow affordable housing. They only allow for single family homes.
Lanessa Chaplin is a lawyer with the New York Civil Liberties Union and is finding housing inequality is getting worse and can be traced to policies as much as any economic situations.
There are entire municipalities in our county that have zero affordable housing. I'm saying zero. Syracuse hosts a third of the affordable housing, but they're all in concentrated areas. And so you end up having concentrations of affordable housing in impoverished areas. And that's what makes our county, our city, be one of the highest ranking in the nation of having high concentration poverty. And what that really means is that you have a lot of poverty compiled onto each other, which then you know you have all these issues that come along with poverty compiled on with each other. And that's because of our zoning laws. The suburban communities don't want affordable housing because they don't want the riffraff. But we know there's a lot of undertones of racism in that language, or not even racism always, but it's just otherism, right? They worked hard to get here, so why should people who haven't worked as hard be able to live in our neighborhood and be afforded our opportunities?
Another issue Chaplin addresses is how place not only can limit opportunities, but have very real effects on health, often because of environmental racism.
The south side of Syracuse being labeled the hotspot. Over 600 kids had lead poisoning. We also have the Midland sewage plant. We also have the Syracuse University steam plant. And then we have I-81, all concentrated in the same area. And so that's what we call structural racism. And that's why you're seeing these higher rates of COVID-19 in these communities. It's not because they're living in poverty. It's not because they can't afford their rent. It's because they're living in the most toxic zip codes in our nation. And so they have been predisposed to all of these medical conditions.
So the agencies and individuals trying to improve housing, environmental and health conditions, jobs in the economy for people in poverty are seeing all those issues exacerbated by COVID. Both city and some agency officials, however, say that doesn't mean there aren't efforts to try and help. And many of those have been impacted by COVID as well. The obvious squeeze is financial. Trying to provide services when government contracts, donations, or other income are all down. But in some ways, the pandemic has focused efforts to help.
Just the system itself drags out. Government is slow, 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 slow.
Deputy Mayor Sharon Owens sees firsthand how public programs can struggle.
Those systems of regulations that cause it to be slow are actually vital because it protects you, the citizenry, from government. But I have to start with housing stability. Where you lay your head, is that place affordable, clean, healthy, accessible, is critical. And when we talk about segregated poverty, I want to make sure we're distinguishing something. People live in neighborhoods that they are familiar with, they're comfortable with. And as human beings, we love to live with people who are like us. The problem comes when those communities are disparately underfunded, when the housing quality, every house on the block has code violations. Every other house is vacant. We have anti-displacement policies that we can establish, programs that we can establish as development happens in our community, as 81 transforms various parts of our community. What do we do to make sure that people who live there can stay there?
Initially, when we were at the height of the pandemic, we wanted to keep as much service on the road as possible. We were down considerably, better than 70% of our ridership, but the people that we were still moving were essential workers. And two, there are people that have no other mode of transportation. So they needed us to get to work or to doctor's appointments or to grocery stores.
As CEO of Centro Buses, Brian Schultz is trying to make the most of the changes COVID sent his way, which could help those trying to fight their way out of poverty.
At the height of the pandemic, we were down 125 employees, most of them bus operators. So we are using this lower ridership period to really take a look at our system and see where we can improve the service, enhance the service for the people that need the bus service the most, and increase frequency, and also help get to employers that are out in the suburban areas, that have the higher paying jobs with benefits. You know, it doesn't make sense to us to just try to shuffle people to two or three different minimum wage jobs when we can get them to one that would cover the same or more income and also offer some benefits as well.
Another aspect of our society so changed by the COVID pandemic is how much we're forced to do online, whether that's working, medical visits, and of course, education. Deputy Mayor Owens was already working on how to make access to the world through broadband as equitable as possible.
One thing around the educational system that absolutely hit full circle was the digital divide, finding ourselves inside and needing to be educated, our children being educated. I made calls myself to Spectrum about policies that they had regarding past due accounts and needing to forgive those so that kids could get access to the internet to be able to learn. COVID seemed to derail so much stuff, but what we were moving on highly was in Syracuse Surge, really addressing that digital divide, using our city-owned community centers to create those hotspot spaces so we can increase that access to the internet, which is, you can't function without it.
Chaplin at the NYCLU also says they're not resting on a number of issues, including the environmental justice front.
So we've been working really hard to think of litigation strategies and potentially filing suit against President Trump for all of the environmental law things that are coming down the pipelines that will inherently impact Black and brown communities. It's really kind of sad how obvious it is that these things are occurring during this uncertain time. So we are still trying to stay very active on that lens, but also we kind of shifted gears. And so we did an education survey to figure out who had access to education, who had access to internet, what were some of the disparities. So what we did is we looked across the state at different school districts, see who's doing what well, if there's something that works, and then hopefully coming out with a toolkit relatively quickly to try to overcome some of these, you know, unplanned, unpredictable barriers that we're now facing.
So the speakers at the virtual town hall largely agree the coronavirus has at least made worse any of the fallouts of poverty and complicated anyone's attempts to rise above it. But they see the most intractable component and cause of poverty is racism, which has to be addressed on a more fundamental level than the pandemic.
The intersections of anti-poverty and anti-racism is essentially this. You don't get poverty without racism, right? You don't get excluding people from accessing employment and jobs based on color, ability, national origins, and then get to poverty as a conversation. And so that's the crux. And you can't be an anti-poverty initiative and not be an anti-racist initiative. That doesn't make sense. You have to talk about how it deeply impacts Black and brown people. You have to talk about the fact that it is not only Black and brown people who are impoverished. There are many, many white people, right, who are in poverty here in Syracuse. And so it doesn't help us to just say that poverty looks a certain color or looks a certain way.
Just as they set out to put policies together to always keep in mind the stories of the people living in the communities, don't look beyond the story initially, because I think in those narratives lies the solution, right? And not to make policies that re-traumatize people. A lot of times in the not-for-profit sector, we offer the olive branch for programs and invite people into our individual institutions. And the first thing that we do to people who are suffering from trauma, high levels of anxiety, stress, depression, grief, loss, we give them a 50-page questionnaire to fill out, right? That's not fair to those individuals, because we don't know what it took for them to even muster the strength to get out of the bed to come see us in the first place. So I think as we move forward, we got to infuse healing into our policies to make programs and institutions incubators of healing before we can start to add more programs or more policies to the table.
Racism and discrimination is the cause of poverty, point blank, period. That intersectionality of poverty and race begins from the inception of this country. So we have been attempting to climb out of that foundational hole from the inception of this country. It causes poverty and it hinders any attempts to alleviate poverty. Their policies are developed traditionally based on race, period.
As you can't get rid of one without the other, and the deputy mayor just hit it right on the head. You cannot end poverty until you end racism, and especially racism in the workplace. Once you get racism out of the workplace, out of educational institutions, where people now have access to good-paying jobs and great educations, that's when you're gonna solve this problem.
Centro CEO Brian Schultz. And before that, we heard from Deputy Mayor Sharon Owens again, Noble Jennings Bay, and Talina Jones. Coming up, we'll hear again from Osha Keaton and Todd Gailey about community action, managing multiple stresses during the pandemic, and the challenges still ahead. This is Syracuse Speaks. Stay with us.
There's so many people doing this work. So there's human service organizations, and we have one way of talking, but then there's healthcare providers, and there's government officials, and there's law enforcement. And if we could get everybody kind of moving in the right direction, I think we could see more progress.
At WAER, we want to say thank you to all of the listeners who made a gift during our recent fall member drive. Your dedication to financially supporting the community-focused, quality journalism WAER brings you, your willingness to engage with us and with each other, helps WAER stay fiscally strong. You are the heart and soul of WAER. Thank you.
Welcome back to Syracuse Speaks on 88.3 WAER. I'm Chris Bolt with Katie Zilkowski. We're talking to two local nonprofit leaders about what difficulties the community is facing in the wake of the coronavirus pandemic.
Earlier, we heard from Greater Syracuse Hope Executive Director Osha Keaton and Peace Inc. Community Engagement Manager Todd Gailey about what their separate surveys found the community needs to recover stronger. They also say there are still challenges ahead.
The community response does seem pretty incredible to this data. I mean, the number of people who are reaching out, who are utilizing it in their own circles. It's got to be a little frustrating for that political capital aspect to still kind of feel siloed off, especially when it feels like you're expanding the table in this direction, but it's not totally reaching over here. Mm-hmm.
I have to give the disclaimer. So first, we're a nonprofit.
Yeah.
So there are real limits to what we can do in sort of being a pressure. That being said, community action, which is the basis of peace, is intended for advocacy. And part of advocacy is education. So the grassroots aspect of this, honestly, that's what I've always kind of focused on. I don't even want to say politicians, because it's not even politicians. It's bureaucracy.
Yeah.
I would say, do I want decision makers to take this seriously? Absolutely. Do I want policymakers to take these ideas and suggestions seriously when they come from the community? That feels much more important and much more impactful to me.
Yeah, and I can say... For me, just speaking, on behalf of the initiative, the goal is to amplify the voice of the community. Yes, I would want decision makers and policy writers and influencers to take a long, critical serious look at the work, absolutely. But more importantly, I want to influence the next wave of political leaders, thought leaders, and give them the tools of empowerment so that they can speak out and advocate for themselves. Because if you think about some of our current political leaders or policy leaders right here in the city of Syracuse, a lot of them got their starts from grassroots, working at smaller agencies, working for like neighborhood associations, seeing a need and got out there and did the work. And you saw a resurgence of that with the protests. Those young people who got together and did, you know, that protest 40 days, 40 nights, that was inspiring to me. Talking about amplifying the voice of the community, like that's what I have in mind. Like those are the thoughts that I have. And I also know too, right, from working on the other side of the aisle, I used to work in city government. Sometimes it can appear that they're not paying attention, but in all actuality, they're watching very closely. But because of other things that you may not even be aware of, they have to make sure they're framing the level of support, I guess, in a cautious way, so as to not maybe deter or detract from anything that they have coming up in the future. I think it goes right back to what Ty just said. The main goal is to make sure we're always empowering and advocating on behalf of the community, giving them history so that they know, like, what you're doing is phenomenal, and you're also standing on the shoulders of other people who fought this fight, and these are some of the tools they use, or this is some of the, you know, missteps they made, so you don't have to make them.
People want to be informed. I think it's a real misnomer that people just want to learn something and then move on to the next thing. I think documents and the responses we've gotten from these documents is that people want to have informed positions about things. I think we've tried to write this in an open-ended way that says, hey, this is intended to be a dialogue.
Shifting gears just a little bit, I mean, to talk a little bit about finances with the city and the county, things are tight and rough right now because of the pandemic. Are there initiatives or projects that either of you guys are afraid will get lost sort of in this hard time?
Can I say Greater Syracuse Hope?
The elephant in the room. So, yes.
I don't want to put you on the spot, but
well, I mean, so The harsh reality of it is that the pandemic created financial strain just for all forms, right? National, state, local. And as most people are aware, all of my funding comes from the state. And so, you know, as they're kind of prioritizing and trying to figure out what's the best way to move forward and which programs are most critical in helping us kind of navigate out of this pandemic. New York State, they have to shift their focus, not because they don't believe in the work of Greater Syracuse Hope or the Esprit initiative, but just because it's a pandemic, right? And so that means that the majority of our partners, they have to pivot, and pivot could look like they find other funding sources, or pivot could look like they pause for a second on those programs that were majority or solely funded by Greater Syracuse Hope. Some of those services have been critical during a pandemic. Again, I'm just thinking about the youth services, the Let Me Be Great initiative, and they continue serving through the pandemic. And that meant providing cleaning supplies, that meant doing wellness checks from like pulling up to people's houses and just kind of standing on the porch and saying, show me your face type of deal. Trying to figure out ways to communicate, even if it was Facebook Messenger, to try to combat that social isolation that Todd and I talked about earlier. So that is a real fear. Even if Greater Syracuse Hope has to go away because of a reshift in financial priorities for the state. I hope that the spirit of the initiative doesn't leave the community, and that the lessons learned from the initiative remains like everlasting lessons and kind of becomes interwoven into the fabric of this community and how we do programs and how we approach the citizens of this community and valuing their input and their voice and their lived experience. And, you know, I pray that doesn't leave no matter what happens with the initiative. So the other thing, too, that I'm concerned about, and I've been saying this anytime someone asks, is the housing situation. I could just be being a worrywart. I don't know, but I just feel like when the moratorium becomes lifted, there's going to be a lot of people who are so far behind in rent that they just can't catch up. And so when you think about a place like the city of Syracuse, where we already have a housing shortage, what does that mean? Like, if we have a mass amount of people who all of a sudden lose their housing, where do they go? Like, what happens? But on the flip side, you know, for the landlords that rent, and this is a second income, you know, it's probably sound weird for me to say this, but I do feel for them as well, because a lot of them, you're not talking about people who are like super rich. We're not talking about like corporations. You know, we're talking about someone who maybe owns one income property in addition to going to work or whatever the case may be.
OSHA articulated it far better than I could. I think you can make an argument for the housing. One of the problems with the rental moratoriums is I'm not necessarily sure the communication to the public about what exactly was a rental moratorium mm-hmm. was clear. I wonder how much grassroots organizations like Syracuse Tenants Union mm-hmm. or how much an organization like Greater Syracuse Hope or Peace, how much were we involved and engaged with this matter of the rental moratoriums? It concerns me that even in good times or the first moments of the crisis, there were struggles to get individuals' voices, especially those who we serve, in the decision-making process. I have even greater concerns when funding starts dropping, programs start going away, because the emphasis, and this isn't being critical, I mean, it's partly a function of the budget, but the emphasis is more about how do we make this a cost-effective program rather than how is this program best serving the public.
Yeah, it's a lot going on. I mean, for both of your organizations, how do you guys keep going? I mean, you have been in this pandemic fog of issues that topple on top of each other and cause just like a lot of confusion for an outsider, let alone someone who's working in these neighborhoods and communities. How do you manage?
I like that phrase, pandemic fog.
That's my pandemic fallout, yeah.
I think just putting one foot in front of the other, this is probably so bad to admit this, but I don't have a real plan. Like, because now I have to work from home due to health issues that I have. I have a chronic illness, so I'm one of those high-risk individuals, right? So I'm working from home. And I felt like disconnected from the work because the crux of my work is going out into the community and talking to people and all of that. And so I was like, well, I need to see how people are doing. And I survey. And so I just had this idea, and then it kind of went from there. I don't have a plan. One of my father's quotes is like echoing in my head because he was military. He used to say, if you fail to plan, you plan to fail. But I just don't know if it makes sense in times like this to say this is the plan, because you better have a contingency plan and then a contingency plan to the contingency plan.
So a lot of what OSHA said kind of resonated with me. I also have a chronic disorder that makes me especially vulnerable right now. Mm-hmm. And I think I don't want to blame the work, but we've both had illness throughout this.
Yeah.
And so I will say what helps me get through the work is that producing work allowed me to meet people like OSHA, who I knew from afar, but I hadn't gotten to know personally. I don't have a plan either. My boss and I joked about how we thought COVID would allow us to have this time to do all of this work that we had imagined that we were going to get to, and we never had time to. And we said that was going to happen in March, and then we said it was going to happen in April, then we said it was going to happen in May, and then in June, we've been in crisis mode for 4 months. And it starts getting to the point that this isn't going to let up. And so you had better find some strategies for taking care of yourself, because if you don't take care of yourself, you're not going to be able to help anyone else. So I know personally, I had trouble coping and dealing with this. And so part of what drove me to do the work and throw myself at the work was partly guilt that I couldn't be, because of physical ailments and chronic disease, I couldn't, from a health standpoint, simply be doing the work on the ground that I'm accustomed to. Selfishly, this is probably the most wildly productive period of my life. Mm-hmm. But it took a lot of work to get it to a balanced, to balance where the work is good and the work is also healthy. So all of this is to say, how do I deal with this? I watch a lot of bad movies.
Oh, yeah.
I try to find some ways to have balance. I have colleagues and friends who I reach out to, and we kind of decompress together, like OSHA. I am driven to improve the community. And so if there is a plan, what I want to do, I want to make sure that it's productive and it helps empower the community.
Yeah, that's always like the driving force.
Yeah.
Is that, making sure that the community needs are identified and then met to the best of, your ability. Because, during this time, it's I don't want to say it's easy, but you could find yourself kind of just like shutting off. And from the rest of the world and shutting down. And there's nothing wrong with that either, because if that's what you need to do for survival, then by all means, take care of yourself first. Because it's just like what they say on an airplane, you have to put on your own oxygen mask before you try to go around saving other people. Yep. What Ty said resonated with me as well, being when you do have a chronic illness and you are higher risk, but your work is in the community, you do kind of feel like, how do I recenter, and like, what is my role in all of this now? And so just being flexible to that and doing frequent check-ins with yourself too, because I think we both could agree that we could easily find ourselves working way too many hours. There's been times where we've sent each other emails either very early in the morning or kind of late at night, and it's like, are you still working? Like, look who's talking, type of thing. So, I mean, just being cognizant of that, but I don't know, it's hard to plan during times like this, and it does not seem like it's going to let up. No. Because now, over the summer, it was just trying to find your footing and figure out what is this that's happening all around us. And now it's the issue again with the children and trying to acclimate them back into school, and then even, college students coming in. And I'm sure once we think we have a handle on that, the winter is going to bring its own set of challenges. So,
Well, lastly, I just want to end with asking either of you if there's something that you think is important for the community to know, either about your project, about community needs in general during the pandemic.
I think as far as assessing community needs, I think it's important to remember, much like we're being flexible and we don't have a plan, the data is always, it needs to be elastic,
yep.
Right? And you want to make sure that you're asking the right questions, the hard questions, and not being wedded to an outcome. Being open-minded to wherever it takes you. I think about the Jerry Gawowski report, Architect of Segregation, which birthed Greater Syracuse Hope, for you know, for lack of a better term, because that was a housing report. He wasn't even studying poverty per se. He was looking at housing inequality. And from that research, he was able to identify Syracuse and our issue around concentrated poverty due to the hypersegregation of housing. And so that's a classic example, probably one of a million, about how you just have to let the research lead you. You just have to let the community kind of guide you as to what their needs are. You shouldn't parachute in and profess to know all things and be all things, because you're not. You can learn more from them in some aspects than they can from you.
COVID is a tragedy. COVID's also an opportunity. And I think that's something to remember when we're talking about community needs. The protests have been robust and they've been sustained. And they are not your typical protesters. Mm-hmm. You are seeing a broad coalition in many ways of people who are coming and raising concerns. There are a lot of problems here in Syracuse, and these reports bring it out. But there are successes, and there are opportunities. Public housing came at Pioneer Homes, and it was originally intended for white residents. Mm-hmm. People organized and rallied and challenged it. They were successful in desegregating to some degree that space. Part of assessing community need is not just to focus on what we're lacking, but also to assess what the strengths of the community are as well. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of empathy in the community, and there's a lot of self-support. And so part of what I'd like to talk about with the white paper, what we've tried, is that if you're going to change things, you can't just poke holes at it. You have to have a strengths-based approach. Greater Syracuse Hope with their programs pursued that by talking with the public and incorporating their ideas into it. So there are problems, but there are real concrete developments that can be built upon.
That was Osha Keaton of Greater Syracuse Hope and Todd Gailey of Peace Inc. The community is not shut down the way it was in March. Local infection rates have dropped and stayed relatively lower. But the need for change in action remains, as many of our neighbors are struggling, often in more ways than one.
Osha and Todd hope their data, along with the ongoing white paper series, will help policymakers and community members come together for lasting change. If you want to hear this program again or listen to past Syracuse Speaks programs, you can go to our website, waer.org. Syracuse Speaks is a production of Syracuse Public Media. Our executive producers are Kevin Kloss and Joe Lee. For Katie Zilkowski, I'm Chris Bolt. You're listening to 88.3 WAER Syracuse.